its quest to provide an open forum for discussion of controversial issues, this station allows hosts and their guests to express themselves without any significant censorship. You're advised that any views expressed by the hosts or their guests are not necessarily the views of Tug Entertainment or its partners.
Welcome to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com. And hosted by editor-in-chief of Officer.com and 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Officer Radio is your source for the latest news, trends, and issues facing the law enforcement community. Join us each week as Officer Borelli and his guest examine, dissect, and discuss the issues facing our industry. Call in live and join the conversation to get your voice heard. Now, let's get to it. It's Officer Radio, live with Frank Borelli on Officer.com.
Good afternoon, law enforcement community. How are you today? Welcome to Officer Radio, brought to you by Officer.com. I'd like to offer thanks today to LE Gear and to WTG Tactical for sponsoring today's show. Both provide gear that makes life easier and helps get the job done. Please visit legear.com and wtgtactical.com for all your equipment needs. I'm your host, editor for officer.com, Frank Borelli, and today we're going to talk about active shooter response evolution. Now, this is a two-part conversation. We're going to talk about active shooter evolution in the United States, where it started, where it's been, where we've come to with it, and then the response evolution part, which really didn't start, if you will, until probably 1999 with the Columbine event, or after the Columbine event. But there was a lot that happened prior to 1999 and Columbine that affected how we evolved our responses and the protocols and the policies that were in place. Active shooters have been a reality in our country for far too long, but a process or policies rather for how law enforcement responds to them wasn't standardized really until after the Columbine event. In the past 13 years since then, protocols and policies have changed at a fairly regular pace, and today there are a number of qualified opinions, and I say qualified opinions, I mean different experts in law enforcement training who have differing opinions on how best to respond to any active shooter event. We're going to discuss those with today's guest, Mr. Jason Stoddard, owner and president of the Warrior Training Group, a nationally recognized trainer. Jason is also an active duty law enforcement professional who deals with the realistic potential of responding to an active shooter event in every shift that he works. Now, that doesn't mean that Jason works in an area saturated with schools, business offices, malls, and so on. It means he's a day-to-day on-the-street officer. I'm not at liberty to discuss his agency or his rank. I'll leave that to him if he chooses to. But Jason puts on a uniform every day and goes to work. He's a trainer, and he has trained nationally for different organizations. He started the Warrior Training Group, and they've built an excellent name in the industry. As a spinoff of that, he started WTGTactical.com. Catalog or online catalog gear company. Good deals, always a discount for law enforcement, so check them out during the show, after the show, whatever. Jason's going to join us so we can talk about active shooters, how it's evolved, and how our response has evolved. Throughout the show, we'll be taking calls from our listeners. The number to dial is 866-404-6519. That's 866-404-6519. If you have a comment, question, observation, or other thought to share, please don't hesitate to dial me up. I've received only one email in the history of doing the show, so I'm not going to invite people to email me comments during the show. It cuts down on the bandwidth and also causes some technical difficulties with the connectivity that we have to do the radio show, so I am not going to be checking emails during the show. If you have a comment, question, or observation, please call our number, 866-404-6519. Now, with that done, what else do I have to tell you guys before we get the show kicked off? Today's show, like all of them, will be archived on Officer.com radio page, as well as our podcast page. To find it for reference or future listening, look up on your screen the blue navigation bar. You'll see the link for Officer.com radio right next to the link for the podcast library. You might want to bookmark one or both for future shows, number one, and for past shows as reference material, number two. The archive shows are also available on iTunes, but they're listed only by date, not by topic. So what you do if you want them on iTunes, come to our podcast page, look at the topic material find what you're looking for, match it to the date, then go on iTunes, download the appropriate one with the date. As you hopefully well know, Officer.com has both a Facebook fan page and a Twitter feed. Any updates we plan for the radio show, schedule guests, etc., get posted on the Facebook page and posted to Twitter accordingly. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We do follow back 99% of the time. Not only do we appreciate the interaction, but it allows us to serve your information needs better. So with all that out of the way, let's get into active shooter. Now, every week when we plan a radio show, we put up an article on officer.com, and this week in response to it being about active shooter response evolution, somebody, one of our readers, put up a comment that said the first recorded school violence was in Pennsylvania in 1764. Obviously, it wasn't called Pennsylvania then, I don't think. I'm not a history buff. A teacher and either 9 or 10 children were killed. 3 survived. Now, I haven't been able to document this. This is from this comment. I haven't done the research on it to see if it was there. My own research documented the first mass shooting of students in New York in 1891, and we'll talk about that event in a little bit. But even that's 123 years ago. It says it resulted in minor injuries to several students. 123 years of known violence, even if we're not reaching back to 1764, more than a century of known risk to our children in our schools of violent behavior. It took until 1999 before we really adjusted or even developed any tactics to deal with it and the potential of it. 108 years later, are we behind the curve? Yes, we're behind the curve. Is it intentional? I think it's the nature of the beast. Before I get into that, the rest of this reader's comment was that an April 30th, 1866, that's April 30th, 1866, editorial in the New York Times argued against students carrying pistols. And there's a quote in here about how a 12-year-old boy had his pants made with a pistol pocket at a boarding school filled with boys who the New York Times writer assumed either would want to do the same thing or was doing the same thing. And those were 12-year-old boys carrying pistols in school. The editorial said they'd advise parents to look into it, learn whether shooting is to be part of the scholastic course, which may be practiced on their boys. Now, I submit to you that a scholastic course isn't practiced on students. It's taught to students, and the students practice the material they learn. So, obviously, the editorial, if this is quoted accurately, had a little bit of a skewed message. Continuing on out of this comment, it says, or else we advise them to see that their own boys are properly armed with the most approved and deadly pistol, and that there may be an equal chance at least of their shooting as of being shot. In other words, if you're going to go to school where people are carrying guns, we advise you to carry an approved gun, a most approved and deadly pistol, so you have a chance to shoot back. That's not Frank Borelli's opinion, that's not Officer.com's opinion, that's reading out of this quote from an editorial allegedly in April 30th, 1866, New York Times. Can you imagine that today? My son's 14 years old. If he went to school with a little teeny tiny plastic government model 45 out of his G.I. Joe kit, he'd get suspended and sent home, and the police might actually get called. We've come a long way from the 1866 12-year-old boy who's having his pants made with a pistol pocket in it, and the parents are being advised, if one kid's carrying, all kids should carry. Make sure you do what you think is right for your kid. Whether or not firearms were being taught as part of the regular scholastic curriculum doesn't seem to cause anybody any big concern. I submit to you, and this is just Frank Borelli's opinion, not the opinion of Officer.com, any of its other employees, the science representatives, blah, 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 all the lawyer talk. I'm not in favor of students taking guns to school. However, I think we may have gone a little bit over the edge when we're punishing kids for having little teeny tiny plastic G.I. Joe 45s that are about the size of your pinky fingernail, and or the kindergarten boy who got suspended for drawing a picture of a gun in school. I think maybe we're getting a little bit out of hand the wrong way. That being that as it may, obviously all of the zero tolerance for guns in schools and violence in schools has not prevented that from getting into our schools, And as a result, we have had, I'm not saying that zero tolerance has caused active shooter events. I'm just saying the failure of it to keep guns out of schools. Obviously, students still get a hold of guns if they want them. They still can come into schools and shoot people with them if they choose to. And the topic of discussion for today is how we in law enforcement most efficiently respond to that, what policies and protocols we should be using. Looking back at the history of active shooter evolution in the United States, what lessons should we have learned and what should we be doing to adapt our protocols and our policies beyond the minimum necessary that we – after Columbine, folks, the public outcry was such that police departments had to develop an active shooter response protocol. Police departments did. I guess the question I'm trying to articulate is, did we do enough? Have we evolved to the point where we need to be, or are we still behind the curve? Are we still only doing the bare minimum we need to do, or are we being more forward-thinking? Are we preparing our police officers, our student staff, faculty, our community, our lawfully licensed civilian carrying, gun-carrying community? Are we doing everything we can as a whole nation to respond or to prepare to respond to active shooter events to minimize casualties, to minimize the loss? One of the things we're going to talk about is the event at Virginia Tech and the absolutely phenomenal response there. You don't get any better, in my opinion, than having two fully equipped SWAT teams on the scene of an active shooter within 2 minutes. The only way you get better is if you have armed cops in the room when it starts. But we still look at the number of casualties that were created there by Sung-hee Cho with 32 dead, 30 in one building, two in a different building, and then taking his own life, which is typical for a lot of active shooters if we look at it historically. We're going to look at that and the responses, and is there anything we could do better? They got a lot of criticism. So when we come back from the break, we're going to have Mr. Jason Stoddard with us from WTGTactical.com, Warrior Training Group. We're going to talk about active shooter response and the evolution of active shooters in the United States. We'll talk to you after the break. Stay with us.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. In May of 2011, a small brown-eyed boy proudly showed off the law enforcement buttons he had pinned to his shirt in honor of his dad, an officer killed in the line of duty 6 years ago. Then the reality set in. This boy was just a few days away from his sixth birthday. He never got the chance to meet his dad, nor did thousands of children whose parents' names are forever etched into the living memorial in Judiciary Square. Join us in 2012 as we launch Officer World Expo in Washington, D.C. in our effort to reduce the intolerably large number of officers who didn't get to go home to their families. OfficerWorldExpo.com, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Get ready for resources, tools, and support to help you build a successful business and live an awesome life. It's the Women's Business Success Show with your host, founder of the Association of Women Entrepreneurs, Tara McHugh. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Central here on the Rockstar Radio Network. Each show will feature a special guest interview. Tara will bring you highly successful entrepreneurs sharing their stories of success. You'll hear about the challenges they faced along their journey together with the advice they have to help you achieve more. You'll also hear from various personal and business development experts sharing tips, solutions, and strategies that you can easily implement into your business and life for amazing results. For more on Tara and her show, check out her website, aofwe.com. Then join us for the Women's Business Success Show with your host, the founder of the Association of Women Entrepreneurs, Tara McHugh. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Central here on the Rockstar Radio Network. Welcome back to Officer Radio. powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by editor-in-chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
Good afternoon again, listeners. Welcome back to Officer Radio on Officer.com. Today, the show is brought to you by LE Gear and WTG Tactical. We've actually have the owner, operator, president, head honcho from Warrior Training Group, which is what WTG stands for, with us, Mr. Jason Stoddard. How are you today, sir?
Good afternoon, Frank. How are you?
I am good. You sound so uptight and serious, man. Relax and enjoy the show.
Okay? I'm trying to sit out on my deck and enjoy the 70-degree day in Southern Maryland.
Isn't it beautiful? I wish I was out on my deck, but I'm inside on a radio channel. So, but after the show, that's where I'm going to be, out on my deck with a cigar and a cold soda. You can bet your rear end. But listen, today we're talking about active shooter, the evolution of it in the United States, how it's come to really be almost part of our mainstream day, and the law enforcement response and how that's evolved. Now, I know in our setup emails and stuff, I sent you a document, and in that document had a list of school-related attacks. Now, obviously, active shooter is not restricted to schools anymore. We've seen them in malls. We've seen them in business buildings. I mean, we even have a term for it, going postal, because they happen in post offices a few times. But on the document that I sent you, the earliest one that I could find was April of 1891 in Newburgh, New York, when a 70-year-old guy fires a shotgun at a group of students in a playground at a parochial school. Now, that's 123 years ago. To the best of your knowledge, until Columbine, were we doing anything about violence in schools, active shooters?
I don't believe so. We would respond to the incidents that were given to us. Since 1999, and then shortly thereafter in 2011, law enforcement has changed forever. We've had to go from just being the officers that responded to domestics and the destruction of properties and things like that to now we are the country's war fighters. We have a lot of things that go on in the United States that we're now responsible for. A lot of the military training that many of us got as veterans is now equating to some of the things that we'd have to do on a daily basis in law enforcement. We're starting to progress through that. In my research that I've done, it doesn't appear that there was any type of consistent response to school violence or active shooters. You didn't really hear the term active shooter until we hit Columbine in 1999.
Let me ask you something, because I believe there's another event prior to 99, and it was an active school shooter. It was just very unique, and I'm talking about the Texas Tower incident with Charles Whitman in 1966 down in Austin, when he went up the top of the tower, barricaded himself in, and started shooting people. Marine Corps trained shooter, engaging people out to 500 yards away with deadly effectiveness. Now, we didn't evolve any active shooter response out of that, but that's one of the events that's credited with the development of SWAT. And here's why I connect the two. When we developed special operations for law enforcement, we kind of took even some more risk work away from the patrol guys. I mean, prior to 66, you had to deal with whatever came your way. Now, and then 66 happens, we develop SWAT, and then patrol guys get told, set up a perimeter, maintain communications, wait for SWAT. Do you think that we actually harmed the effectiveness of patrol in response to violent situations when we separated out SWAT and developed that protocol?
I do. We took a lot of the basic training, the basic knowledge that needed to be given to every police officer, and we gave it to a specialized group of people that needed it, but everybody needs to have that training. One of the things that I talk about when I go around and teach is we in the United States tend to concentrate on Columbine, Virginia Tech, what happened at Nickel Mines and things like that, but when was the last time we did any training that dealt with the Malat attack in the Philippines or what happened in Beslan? If we truly want to classify ourselves as being prepared for something along those lines, we have two blueprints of what terrorists have tried to do to schools that they want to do here. And what kind of training are we doing with that?
Well, I will submit to you a thought, and we'll get to it probably a little bit later in the show for more conversation, because you and I think very much alike. I submit to you, and bear in mind that we've been to some of the same schools. As you know, I live in Southern Maryland. I went to my first active shooter response instructor program in the year 2000, and it was hosted by St. Mary's County Sheriff's Department. The lead instructor, great guy. I'm sure you know who he is, but I don't want to say his name. Why the hell with it? He's Sheriff Timmy Cameron now. He's a sheriff in St. Mary's County. He was the lead instructor, phenomenal instructor. He was also my sniper instructor, by the way. And then I did the same school again a year or two ago. The school was taught down in Northern Virginia, but the primary instructor was Lieutenant Ricky Thomas from over here in Calvert. And it was the active shooter instructor school, so they're teaching us how to teach officers to respond to active shooters. But we're still, for the most part, focusing on 4 or 5-man diamond and responding to student-age shooters such as we saw at Columbine. I submit, and I have a feeling you'd agree with me, that if we wanted to truly be effective, we would be training for a terrorist attack or multiple terrorist team attacks, which are going to be, as a rule, minimum of 4 or 5 terrorists and the team working together. And that if we trained for that, neutralizing 1 or 2 students wouldn't be quite as difficult. What do you think?
I agree. You agree totally. The old adage of train for the worst and hope for the best. We have been behind. Even if you look at, you talk about multiple teams attacking, look at what happened in India. What are we doing to prepare our cities and our metropolises for things like that? There are certain places like New York that do a lot, L.A. that does a lot. But look, what are smaller areas? I grew up in Iowa. What is Des Moines, Iowa doing? What are some of these other these medium-sized metropolitan areas doing to start to train for that? And if we train for the worst, handling a couple kids inside of a school would become much easier for us, because we've trained, we've done the complex incident thought processes, we've went through, we've done the pre-plans, we've done all those things. So now we've got the plan in place. Now we just need to execute it. And the training of that, the integration of with the fire department, with the medical programs, with things like that, wouldn't just be for school attacks. It would be for everything, and the protocol can remain the same.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk more about that, because there is just so much more we can touch on when you look at cross-training with other public safety disciplines. But, you know, you said something, and I want to go back to this. We got about 5 minutes till the break, so I'm hoping we can cover it between now and that break. I was talking to somebody who did some simulation training a couple of weeks ago, and they were put into a scenario where they were on a traffic stop. Dad, the driver of the car, in the vehicle's dad and a little girl, a 10-year-old girl. They know guns are in the car. Dad's got an open warrant for armed robbery. It's a nighttime traffic stop. 2 police officers, and what they do for the simulation is the officer that's being trained is the backup. He's the second officer. He's the passenger side officer. And in the course of this scenario, this 10-year-old little girl gets out of the vehicle with a gun and points it at the police officer. Now, you and I both know, both of us work the street. This is a nightmare for either one of us. I don't know if you've got kids. I got 4, and I can't imagine having to shoot a 10-year-old. But officer after officer after officer that goes through this training stands there and gets shot and killed by this 10-year-old girl. In our country today, we train for active shooter response to kill high school students that have taken guns to school to hunt their fellow students, but we don't usually, not very often if it happens at all, we don't usually emotionally prepare our officers to be shooting pre-adolescents, pre-teens. Do we have to? What do you think?
I think we have to. How many of the guys that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq will tell you that one of the biggest things that they're using over there is the children? And it's not something that's abnormal here. Even what happened in Minnesota, I think down in Texas about 2 months ago, they had a 12-year-old that a group of police officers had to shoot to take down because he had brought a gun to school and refusing to put it down. And it's something when I do the psychology of killing class that we've come up with, when I teach that, you talk to these officers and you tell officers every day, what could come down to the use of lethal force. And we all understand, working the street, that when we shut our eyes at night, we envision the person that may we have to use deadly force on or lethal force in our careers. It's going to be that guy that just got out of prison, or that guy that, you know, he's 6 foot tall. He's been working out his entire life. He's holding a gun, and it's either you or he in an alleyway. When I teach, I have my officers when they shut their eyes, envision if it was a child. Take that kid, put ponytails in that kid, and now that kid's holding an AK-47 pointing it at you. Can you put the front sight on that child and pull the trigger? Because a bullet flies at the same velocity fired from a 10-year-old as it does from a 30-year-old. And it is something that we do have to start to talk to our officers about more often, because as just happened, I think it was in El Paso, a 12-year-old that comes into a school. Not only are we having to take lethal force against that 12-year-old, but now we're having to talk about the emotional trauma that it could cause the officers that are responding, because they're not prepared for that.
Well, let's be realistic, and we're going to talk this into the break in just about a minute probably, but let's be realistic. Anytime an officer has to use deadly force, there's an emotional trauma to the officer. Whether they manage it well or they manage it poorly, the act of taking another human life is not a natural act. We all stress that, and Dave Grossman's talked about that for a number of years. But when you have to take a child's life, and all of us have that strong parental instinct, whether we have children or not, taking care of children is what we are naturally driven to do, not kill children. And when you put your front sight on that child and you pull the trigger, that's what you're doing. It may not be your intent. You know, we talk about shooting to stop the threat, shooting to stop the aggressive act. We're not shooting to kill. We're shooting to stop, to neutralize. Whatever you have to say, when you put two 40 caliber rounds into the space of a 10-year-old's chest, the chances of them not dying are slim to none. And it's a heinous thought. None of us like to consider it. Now, Jason, we're at about the 30-second mark. When we come back, I want to talk about this a little bit more, and I'm actually going to throw my 14-year-old son, who you've met, into this mix when we talk about shooting children. And then I want to get really off the topic of children, if we can, and talk about active shooter active shooter evolution and the response evolution and what we should be doing now. So we're 10 seconds from our break. Stay with us. Jason, stay with us. Thank you for being here. This is Officer Radio on Officer.com. We're going to come back, continue our conversation about active shooter response.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these. Get ready for resources, tools, and support to help you build a successful business and live an awesome life. It's the Women's Business Success Show with your host, founder of the Association of Women Entrepreneurs, Tara McHugh. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Central here on the Rockstar Radio Network. Each show will feature a special guest interview. Tara will bring you highly successful entrepreneurs sharing their stories of success. You'll hear about the challenges they faced along their journey, together with the advice they have to help you achieve more. You'll also hear from various personal and business development experts sharing tips, solutions, and strategies that you can easily implement into your business and life for amazing results. For more on Tara and her show, check out her website, aofwe.com. Then join us for the Women's Business Success Show with your host, the founder of the Association of Women Entrepreneurs, Tara McHugh. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Central here on the Rockstar Radio Network.
Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. Join thousands of other law enforcement professionals attending Police Week, May 12th through the 17th, 2012, in Washington, D.C. The new Officer World Expo at Police Week will offer training, conference sessions, and networking opportunities to better equip those who protect others. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by editor-in-chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
Folks, welcome back again. Thank you for being with us today. Today's show is sponsored by LE Gear and by WTGTactical.com. WTG stands for Warrior Training Group, and if you're just joining us, we actually have Jason Stoddard, the owner and operator of Warrior Training Group, with us. They're nationally known as trainers, and one of the things they do specialize in training is active shooter response. That's why I've got Jason on the show, and I guess I owe him a little bit of an apology. We've brought up a really controversial subject with the idea of shooting children, which as controversial as it may be, also may be very realistic. So, Jason, I do apologize for throwing in that mix so quick out of the gate, but it's something we got to deal with on the street.
Oh, absolutely, it is. It's something that is so polarizing to so many people to think that today you could run a call for a shooting in an elementary school or a middle school, and the threat could be a 12-year-old. And it's not something that we ever want to talk about. When you look at history, you look at what happened in Beslan, and they're using kids as shields. They're picking kids up and using them as shields. And I've had this conversation with multiple people, multiple administrators, even some people that sit at a legislative level of, we have an incident that mirrors a Beslan incident. What is the best course of action if you have somebody who's holding a bomb, that's holding a shield as a child, and the only course of action is to take down that person that has the bomb? And what happens if you do hit that child?
What's worse is if you have to shoot through the child to do that.
Exactly.
Which, if I'm not wrong, is the situation that confronted the lieutenant in the Russian Special Forces. Now, our show producer can hear the birds in the background, Jason. I think that's kind of funny.
I can go inside if you need me to.
No. I had to throw that out there. I thought it was kind of funny. But here's the thing, and I said I was talking about my 14-year-old son, and actually at the moment my youngest son's 14. But when my oldest son was 14, so we're looking 9 years ago, I was doing a lot of firearms training, and one of the things I was trying to get officers to accept was that a kid holding a gun was the equivalent threat of that hardened felon holding a gun. I know that's hard for people to hear, it's hard for people to say, but like you said, the bullet goes the same speed no matter who's holding the gun. It's just as deadly if it's fired at you. I couldn't find any targets that showed children with guns so that I could teach cops it was okay to shoot that.
No.
So I took a picture of my own teenage son at the time, 14 years old, and I blew it up into poster size with a gun in his hand, and I had officers from the agencies that I trained shooting at my son, which a lot of people thought I was just insane. Now, 9 years later, and as I said earlier on the show, you've met my youngest son now, my 14-year-old son. I have told everybody in the presentations I've made, I don't ever expect it to happen. But if my son picks up a gun and goes into school, take him out as fast as you can. There are 14-year-olds out here, and here in Southern Maryland, hunting's a lot more prevalent than it is in some other parts of this state. But around the country, hunting's a very prevalent thing. There are 13, 14-year-old kids. There's 10, 11-year-old kids that can take down a deer at 200 yards with a very accurate shot, and they know what they're doing with the firearms. What makes us think they can't do that to adults?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I shot three-gun in USPSA for years. And we routinely had 11, 12, 13-year-olds that are shooting race guns that have better skills than I did as a police officer. That's a reality of today. There's nothing wrong with teaching your children how to shoot. And when we go back and we look at a historical perspective of the active shooter incidents, most of these kids that have been involved in those incidents aren't the kids whose parents taught them how to shoot. They're not the Boy Scouts. They're not the varsity athletes. These are kids who just picked up a gun, the one in Paducah, Kentucky, where the kid learned how to shoot using a PlayStation.
Yep.
Never touched a real gun before. He takes from a close distance away, he puts 80% of his rounds into the heads of his moving victims. These kids that are doing these things are troubled kids. Most of them don't have the knowledge they're not been taught to respect firearms like my children have, or your children have, or most other police officers' kids have.
Absolutely. But, you know, you touch on a subject of people learning how to shoot playing video games, and I know there are people in the world who believe that first-shooter video games make children into violent criminals, and I've disputed this fact ad nauseum. I believe that there are some video games, like Duck Hunter, if you want, where you have a weapon, and it's a handheld, pistol-shaped object, where you must use proper sight alignment, proper sight picture, proper trigger pull, and get your hits. And you could reinforce some of the basics of marksmanship, but I don't believe that doing that makes them any more willing to be a killer. What's your outlook on this?
No, not at all. I learned how to shoot from Duck Hunt. The original Nintendos that came out, I learned how to shoot, and that hand-eye coordination that's needed to accurately shoot a moving target. When I went into the military, the first FATS machines were coming out, and we were able to train on those. The issue becomes is what is the penalty for messing up? When we're on the line, when we're shooting, there's a instant penalty if you shoot a no-shoot or a friendly or a good guy. There's an instant penalty. In a gaming situation, there is no penalty. The penalty is you lose a couple points. But anymore, you look at a lot of these video games now, when it was my generation, I guess you could say, that started with the whole gaming thing, I can remember you only got three lives, and you had to earn additional lives. I now have a PlayStation 3 that I have the Modern Warfare games, and I never die. I never run out of lives.
And you're talking out of my generation. I learned how to play video games with Pong.
Exactly. The Ataris are now worth $30,000.
I guess.
But there is some stake to the argument that video games are, they're definitely not helping. And especially, I believe, like I said, I have to look through my computer here, but I believe it was in Mississippi with the young man who he stops because he's yelled at by his teacher or by his principal. And that's the only way that he stops shooting. And that can be related to his parents yelling at him while he's playing a video game to stop and come eat dinner. And that was the only way that he was stopped, was by the principal or the teacher saying, stop. And during the interviews that I did, they said that it was like a toggle switch went off in this kid's head.
Well, we're going to change the subject because we can have a whole nother radio show about the emotional conditioning necessary for children to become killers and for law enforcement to be able to safely, I don't want to say safely, efficiently neutralize children. Let's go back to the original purpose of the show. Active shooters in the United States. We've known that there's been violence or violent potential for violence against our students in our schools, according to our one commenter, since 1764, according to my own research, at least since 1891. And then in 1966, we have the Austin, the Texas Tower incident. 1999, we have Columbine. Columbine was really what caused us to change how we do business as law enforcement officers. Why?
Well, the 1999 was towards the beginning of the 24-hour news. You have CNN, Fox News, and all these things that are just starting to come out on cable television. Columbine's one of the first things that hits. That's just huge. It is amazingly large. They have cameras on the scene from Denver, and in a very short period of time, helicopters flying over the area, and you're seeing hundreds of police officers standing outside, and they're not being assigned to do anything. And then the after action report comes out of the initial response, the SRO that exchanged gunfire with the two perpetrators, they never set up or they never went into the school. Up until that point, there was still, we as law enforcement were told, contain and call SWAT.
Now, let's make this a very good point here, because we're not being critical of the people officers who responded to Columbine. They acted within the confines of their training, their policies, and their standard operating procedures. But thanks to the satellite transmissions, like you said, the 24-hour coverage, the ability for the mainstream media to project images of students running out of the school while police officers stood around outside the school, we had a huge public outcry against police officers taking no action while students got hunted. And I think as in the profession as a whole, we had to do a gut check. We had to figure out, are we warriors or are we caretakers? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Not only did we in our profession, but it then transcended into the political environment. Because if you do some research, that the sheriff in Jefferson County was not there after his next election. And you begin to see a tumbling down of how can we fix this. And for those of us who are out here doing this job for the right reasons, we want to do this job. We want that community caretaking function, but we also know that we are society's warriors at this point. And it became a big push in law enforcement that we needed to standardize a lot of what we were doing as a direct result of Columbine. No police officer in their right mind wants to sit outside of a school and listen to homicide occur inside. It is not acceptable to happen after 1999 because everything changed.
But we have police officers, and we're at our 2-minute mark, so I'll let you know when we get close to the break, and we'll discuss this more after the break if we have to. We have police officers. You know some. I know some. They may not want to sit outside, but they don't have the intestinal fortitude to man up, male or female, I don't care, to man up and go into the sound of shots to try to neutralize the threat. They don't have the guts to do it. What do we do with them? I get all worked up here, and I'll have to climb down off my soapbox before I start shouting into this microphone. I find it unacceptable that we have people who take an oath to protect and serve who don't have the guts to protect and serve.
I agree. I agree totally. But at the same time, what are we doing as at an academy level and then as a continuing education level to instill in these in our newer officers and to continue to instill in veteran officers the warrior mindset, the mindset of what we do at the basics of our job? And I think across the country, it is very little. It is very little. When I can walk into departments and show them videotape after videotape after videotape, and we can have conversation after conversation after conversation, and you have Lieutenant Colonel Grossman doing something very similar, and we still have the tremendous amount of officers
Hey, Jason.
Yes, sir.
Hold that thought, because we're getting ready to go into break, and I know the producer. He'll cut us both off to turn on the advertisement, because that's his job. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about this topic more. I've got some comments on it as well. And then hopefully in our last segment, we can actually talk about what we're doing today and how we're supposed to do it. So stay with us. Thank you for being with us. Be back in a second.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. 152. The number of law enforcement fatalities in 2010. The numbers are too high. Any line of duty death is unacceptable. Join us in Washington, D.C. next year during National Police Week at the first ever Officer World Expo as we combine a unique training opportunity with the largest police memorial in the United States. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com for details and to join the mailing list, Officer World Expo, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
The Trick to Getting Published with your host, Florence Blake. Friday nights at 9, 8 central on TogiNet.com. Flo has seen it, done it, and now can share from her experiences as a newspaper staff reporter, feature writer, freelance editor, and college writing instructor. And now Flo has authored a system whereby her students enjoy a 90% success rate in attaining publication of their manuscripts for the first time. In just 4 years, she has over 800 of her own articles published in national magazines, newspapers, and anthologies. Author of several books, including the powerful memoir, The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter, Florence has advised and edited professors, deans, PhDs, and hundreds of students' writings before submission. And now it's your turn. Join us Friday nights with your questions. Most of Flo's students say they've learned much and thoroughly enjoyed the journey. It's The Trick to Getting Published with your host, Flo Blake. Friday nights at 9, 8 central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
All right, listeners, welcome back to our final segment this afternoon. Today's show brought to you by LE Gear and by WTGTactical.com. WTG stands for Warrior Training Group, and we have Mr. Jason Stoddard, owner-operator of Warrior Training Group, with us, and he's putting up with me very well, and I do appreciate it. Jason, I thank you for being on the show today.
Not a problem. Thank you, Frank.
So right before we went to break, we were talking about how we're really not doing any very much in the law enforcement profession, in our hiring, in our academy level, in our veteran conditioning, to really keep the warrior mindset alive. And I would submit to you that we're going the wrong way. Instead of hiring, let me just say this. I've seen some agencies who would rather have a gentleman or a lady who's got a four-year degree in social work instead of a honorably discharged Marine that speaks five languages, has a top secret clearance, and two tours in Afghanistan. And I just happen to think maybe we're looking for the wrong things.
I think there's a lot to there's a lot to go along with that, and I agree with you that I can go into a local academy here not too long ago and asked how many veterans there were in the class of 25 people, and there's none, and it is a shame, and I don't know the reasoning behind that. I've been told in off the record conversations with administrators that there is a fear of hiring, especially combat-hardened veterans. There's a fear of that. And I don't know why that's changed. When you look at what happened in the 60s and the 70s with the guys coming back from Vietnam, they're what made up our police departments.
They're what made up our SWAT teams. Our first SWAT teams were made up of the early returning Vietnam vets.
Absolutely. And why we have gone away from that, personally, I think there's a lot of political issues there. There's a lot of studies have shown that college educated individuals who are simply 22 years old with a 4-year degree create less complaints than those of us who are military veterans that are police officers. There's nothing that's saying that you. I work for some very, very good people, very good cops that they went right out of high school. They went straight to college. They have college. They were never in the military, and they are great cops. But I believe, just like I think you do, that we're missing the boat with a tremendous amount of highly qualified applicants that are coming back from Afghanistan, that have served our country, that are patriots, that have a tremendous amount of training that we in law enforcement are missing, and we need them.
I agree with you 100%. Now, let's talk about, we're going to get off of that, away from that for a minute. Let's talk about how our active shooter response has now evolved. When I did the first class, we were talking 4 or 5 man diamonds. When I did the second class, we were talking 4 or 5 man diamonds. Hasty teams developed to make entry, move to the sound of shots. The second class, instructor level class that I took, was a far cry from the first one. There was smoke, there was noise, there was artificial explosions, pyrotechnic devices. There was multiple teams trying to manage multiple teams, communications being used, simunitions being used, all very different from the first class that I took. But there are also other trainers out here today who are espousing 2-man teams because you get a team in there faster. And if you work from a buddy group and you have 2 of them, then you have a 4-man team. There are some trainers who espouse single man. I mean, if you get there, you're the first cop there and you hear shots, are you going to stand around outside and wait, or are you going to go? I know at least one veteran trainer who said, if it's my kid's school, I can tell you I'm not standing around outside waiting. I'm going hunting. Y'all have to keep up. And I understand his outlook, because if I get to my son's school first, y'all better keep up. I'm not waiting. Now, with all that said, what's Warrior Training Group teach as a proper response team size?
Well, I think you have to train for the myriad of everything. It's my philosophy, and it has been for the 18 years I've been a police officer, that you can't just learn one way to do things. That's very dangerous. How many different ways were we taught when we first started to do a traffic stop? You're taught the offset, you're taught the straight on, you're taught all kinds of different ways. So teach as many as you can, as you're comfortable with. The hall boss, the diamond formations, it's my understanding the history of that comes directly from the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps. And it was a quick fix for what we needed to start to train in 1999.
Absolutely. Hold that thought. And forgive me for interrupting you, but here's my problem. We are not evolving. We're reacting.
Absolutely.
We knew for 108 years minimum that there was violence in our schools. And starting in 1970, it really started to escalate, and we didn't do anything about it as a community, as a law enforcement community as a whole. But have we now gone, okay, we answered the problem. We no longer will we stand outside. The community can't complain. The public can't complain. Now we're going to rush through that door, provided we have four cops. Hold the phone a second. I know a place, and it's a 2,200 square mile county that has five different school districts. And if you put every deputy and every game warden and every reserve officer in a uniform in that 2,200 square miles, you get 22 cops, 22 people. How long is it going to take them to put together a four-man team? It simply won't work.
Absolutely. And you have to train. Have to train for the resources that you have, but B, you have to train. We can't just get into this. We have to have four people. I had a conversation during a class that I was doing with a high-ranking member of one department, and he comes to me and he says, "We just got this four or five-man thing down. Why are you changing it now? That doesn't make any sense to me." And you know, I asked him if he was still driving a 1978 car.
Right.
Because we do have to evolve. We have learned that it is from my understanding that the initial response that was pushed out there through the active shooter stuff was the four and five man diamond, the entry in. Now we're starting to see that there are a tremendous amount of knowledgeable people in this career field. There's a tremendous amount of people who actually are experts that just don't say that. As you talked about in the last time that I was on your show, you know, the guys that you go to their class and you then tell all of your buddies about that person. Go to this class. There's a tremendous amount of those out there. There's a bunch of people who really don't know what they're talking about out there also. But you talk to the people who have been there, who have done it, who have done the research, who put some thought process into this, and it's not just a fad, that sometimes it may be a one or two man entry. When you break down law enforcement as a whole, pretty much across the country, we work in one or two man teams all the time.
Yep.
You respond to a domestic, it's you and your buddy. It's you and the car running the sector next to you. And that's what we're used to. We're not used to a four or five man team. You've been to the training classes when you're going down a hallway of a diamond formation and you're the point guy. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good at all because it's that military tactic. What's the thing with the military and people? You're expendable. If you go down, we're going to put another private right up there.
Well, and let's be realistic, and it is necessary, though. I understand what you're saying. I'm not arguing with you. But if four of us go in and one of us takes a bullet and kids are still dying, I don't want anybody else on my team to slow down to take care of me. Thank God I took that bullet and not some kid. Y'all go get that bastard. That's going to be my outlook.
Well, it's only fair. It is only fair. But we can now move into a philosophy of can we train up our officers on the basic level of tactics, room clearing, not just what you do on an open door at an intrusion alarm, but a tactical room clearing. Can we give them the skills and the tools that if there's only two of them, if you look at my agency and some of the more rural parts of the county, if we have a shooting in one of our more rural parts of the county, you're only getting two officers there. The rest of them are taking 15 to 20 minutes to run priority there.
As they say,
you and your buddy.
I feel you.
And so we have to train that as well. You train the diamond formation, train the hall bosses, and also train the two man. If you personally believe that you can enter the school, be safe, hunt is hunt the bad guy, and you can do it by yourself, and you have to do it by yourself. You have to have the ability to do that. There is nothing out here. I always hear this when I teach. Well, there's two kinds of cops. There's tactical cops, and then there's the non-tactical cops.
I'm throwing the BS flag. Every cop's a tactical cop, or shouldn't
exactly
be wearing a badge.
And we have to understand that. You have to understand that there's no such thing as, oh, well, this guy, he's a real good guy, but he's a bean counter. We are all cops, And we all have to have the ability to fire our weapons and to hit accurately at what we're shooting at. We all have to have the ability to have the tactics. We can all sit down and go, that guy's tactic's not real good, but we just accept it. We can't any longer. It can no longer be acceptable, well, that guy's just going to be a bean counter. When Mr. Bad Guy goes to Walmart and gets his hunting license for the police, he doesn't check the block that says, I only shoot the tactical cops.
You know, I've never heard that one before, but it's not up to us. It's up to it's up to the administration, and they decide who to keep and who not to keep. And I don't want to run anybody out of the business. But in all honesty, if you're not willing to stake up, if you take the oath to protect and serve, and you're not willing to stand up in front of my kid and take the bullet to protect them, then turn in your damn badge.
Absolutely, I agree wholeheartedly
just my
with you.
We're probably getting close to the two. Yep, we just got the 2-minute warning. We definitely can do a whole nother show about more conversation on this because there's so much we didn't even touch. You know, we haven't had a chance to talk about the confusion of multiple teams and managing multiple teams. We haven't talked about self-aid and trauma care. And you and I both know the SWAT medics of Virginia Tech, they earned their money that day and they saved some lives. And I'd love to have more conversation about that. You know, we haven't talked about how do we address the unexpected circumstances. At Virginia Tech, they only had 6 ambulances. And they couldn't use any helicopters because of the high winds that day. The on-scene fire EMS commander was a 23-year-old volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we deal with that stuff? There's so much we got to talk about. What our current public expectations of response are. You know, those two fully equipped SWAT teams at Virginia Tech on scene in under 2 minutes, and you still have people from the media and the public saying they didn't do enough fast enough. Well, we're not miracle workers. There's only so much we can do. You know, and just going back to tactics, Jason, and we're at 1 minute, so we're really not going to get to talk about any of this stuff, but I'm of the opinion that we should be starting out our foundational response training with a 2-man buddy team. And you train 2 guys to work together as best they can. That's the basic room clearing, basic movement. It takes 2-man buddy teams to cover each other when you're doing a fire maneuver, going down a long hallway, anything like that. There's so many more military tactics that we haven't touched on in law enforcement. And now we actually have people at the federal level that are complaining about using military tactics in local law enforcement, whether or not it violates posse comitatus. It's ridiculous. But don't even say a word in response, and I'll apologize for not allowing it. We're under 30 seconds. Thank you for being with us today, Mr. Jason Stoddard. I greatly appreciate it. We want to have you back.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity, Frank.
Thank you to our listeners. We appreciate you being here with our show. Come back for a future show when we talk about active shooter response again. Until then, stay safe. Do it to them before they do it to you.
Thank you for being a part of Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Each week, Officer Radio is